Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. Become a fan of Beyond the Book on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Subscribe to the free podcast and never miss a program at www.beyondthebook.com.
Thank you, everyone, indeed, for joining us this morning at the Samsung Experience. It's a good thing that they're not open for business right now, because I would probably have one of those things they call the credit card experience, right? There's so much here to want, and as Oscar Wilde said, the only thing I can't resist is temptation. So, as Bill said, if you want to win a 3D television rather than pay for one, I would suggest you enter your business card in that raffle. I'm very pleased to be here because it's going to be an interesting discussion about something very important to the book publishing industry, and that is really, so what happens next? And joining me are three panelists who I think have a lot to say about that. Very briefly, from my left, Andrew Albanese from Publishers Weekly, Rachel Cho from Open Road Integrated Media, and Kathleen Conkey, an attorney with her own practice, but with great experience in the media business. And I want to turn first in our discussion to Andrew. Andrew, welcome indeed. You're the features editor at Publishers Weekly, a resident expert on digital publishing. We follow your reporting on the Google Book Settlement, and you do a great job with all of that. And as we were thinking about this program today, we were chatting, and I was sharing with you a story that at a meeting I was at, people were talking about something they referred to as book product, and they said, well, you know, the book is dead. And I said, Andrew, is the book dead? And you told me,
yeah, totally dead. No.
Well, that's good for me. I'm an Irishman. No. You know, I mean, I like a good wake, so maybe we'll have a wake for the book here.
No, the book is far from dead. That's the good news. Is there some transition and upheaval in the industry? Yeah, no doubt. You know, I was at a Wharton Business School event 2 weeks ago, and Judith Kerr from Simon & Schuster was on the dais, and she brought up the point that for an industry that's supposed to be, you know, wheezing in its death throes, everybody wants to get into it. And she's absolutely right. You have Apple and Google and all these major companies that are pushing into books. And if you had told me a few years ago that books were going to be at the forefront of the internet movement, I wouldn't have believed it.
Well, in fact, no one else but Steve Jobs, a few years ago, when the Kindle came out, his comment was, well, he didn't really care about it that much because no one reads anymore. But now he cares about it because he has got something out called the iPad.
That's true. And I think it was Jeff Bezos that said that he didn't read books anymore either, that he was just reading his Kindle. But if you look at the numbers from last year alone, it was the, not the Book Industry Study Group, but
Bowker.
More print books than ever last year. More new editions than ever were put out last year. Old books that have been out of print and left to molder on library shelves are finding new life. And for other authors that traditionally have not been able to crack into traditional publishing, there's more outlets via self-publishing and an explosion of small presses for more people to get their work in front of more readers than ever before. So I think it's just actually quite the opposite. The book is thriving.
But if I can push that a bit, I mean, one of the things that may be, if not dead, then certainly not feeling very well at the moment are some of the business models that the publishers have. That seems fair to say, right?
I guess that's fair to say, but I think that that's true of any business. This is definitely a time of upheaval. But I think publishers will figure it out, and the ones that don't will be replaced by ones that do.
And in fact, you mentioned the Bowker numbers, and if I recall correctly, something like 750,000 ISBNs were issued just in the last year, the majority of those coming from independent publishing. And that's really the game changer, I think, in the business right now.
That's an extraordinary number. It was 750,000. But when an ISBN is issued to any new edition of a book, and so one of the largest issuers of ISBNs was a company called Bibliophile, which I had never heard of until they came out with this extraordinary number. And so I was able to get in touch with the CFO of the company and talk a little bit about their business. And what they've done is they're taking books that are in the public domain that have been out of print for a long time, a lot of foreign editions, and they're creating print-on-demand editions. And those print-on-demand editions are getting new ISBNs. But you're seeing an explosion of these old books that have just sort of been left to fall into oblivion that are getting new life thanks to companies like Bibliophile.
Now, as someone who's been at PW for a fair amount of time, you are covering not just the book industry now, but the technology industry. And I think that's another way that the whole business is changing. It's not just about publishing books. It's about how we publish, where we publish, what we publish it with.
Absolutely. And it's a steep learning curve for me, especially because I come from a publishing background. And like this week, I find myself working on a feature on HTML5. And I'm pretty clueless about this stuff. I mean, I'm maybe savvy, more savvy than most, but I'm still not anywhere close to being savvy.
And for those of us in the audience, including me, who aren't quite as savvy, but I have an idea, why is HTML5 a factor right now for the publishing industry?
Well, from what I'm told, HTML5 is what's going to enable this explosion of apps. They're soon going to be littering your iPads and making life very easy for you, or difficult, depending on your perspective.
So that's really something that is crucial to the success of the iPad, as far as books are concerned.
So they tell me.
All right. Well, how do you feel about so-called enhanced books yourself? I mean, there was a news announcement just earlier this week that Vuk, which is one of the sort of leading enhanced book providers, has a title out from someone with Guns N' Roses, and they're going to be including video along with the memoir, I suppose. How do you respond to that?
I personally think it's exciting. I think that the more creative we are with content and the more ways we can get it out to people and add to it and build on it, I think it's exciting. I think opinion varies in the industry. Evan Schnittman from Oxford University Press was on a panel that I did just over a week ago, and he had a blog post that he put up called Don't Pimp Our Ebooks, and it was great just to hear him say the word pimp on C-SPAN. But basically what Evan was saying is that he doesn't think we need all these bells and whistles in our books. That people just want the content and they want new ways to be delivered, the content delivered to them. And there's some merit to that. On the other hand, there are entire classes of books now that are not going to be books again and will never be e-books either. I'm talking about the Rand McNally's and GPS and maps and even dictionaries, to a point where to think about books and content in that realm is just, it's a little too narrow. The thinking is a little too narrow.
Right. In fact, I've seen a presentation that Evan does where he talks about Oxford University Press's apps for the iPhone, and that's where they really were very successful in moving the dictionaries onto the iPhones, you know, for translation when you're abroad, doing all kinds of things like that. Very special dictionaries for the medical world or technical world and so forth. So they've been very much on the forefront of that effort. Yeah. Well, what do you think this all means to authors? Is it a generational issue? Are we going to have to expect that the born digital generation that's coming up is going to be looking at book publishing in a way that their parents haven't? Or is that misunderstanding what some of the older readers are expecting as well?
I think for authors it represents opportunity. It also represents, once again, some uncomfortable change. But there are more outlets than ever for authors to be published these days, and there's more ways for authors to express themselves beyond just a printed book. So I think that's beneficial. At the same time, it's going to be uncomfortable for a lot of authors to be introduced to the book sale, because a lot of them write for their advances, and then they write for their next advance. And they're, with a lot of the new deals that are coming out now, they're going to actually get out and have to sell books. And that's going to be different for a lot of people in the industry.
Right, and indeed, the digital world is bringing the publishers themselves a good deal closer to their customer than they had been in the past. There were always intermediaries, book distributors, booksellers, who were really the customer as far as the publisher was concerned.
That's true, and you would think that eventually we'll get that right and that that will be a bonus as well, but there's going to be some short-term pain as publishers and authors learn how to direct market to consumers.
Right. Now, so if the book isn't dead, if it's doing reasonably well, where is it doing especially well in the e-world? Again, I think there are some surprises for the audience. It's not just teenagers looking for the memoir from the Guns N' Roses character. It's Harlequin Romance has been one of the most successful e-publishers to date. Tell us about that, and what do you think accounts for that?
I think when you get into the romance market, what you see is a lot of frequent reading, to a point where people are willing to want to get a chapter just sent to their iPhone that day. The Harlequin and the romance industry in general has been extraordinary with their uptake of technology. They really are, in many respects, as are science fiction, sort of leading the way when it comes to ebooks. But reference information, too, is a big part of this. And I think when we talk about ebooks, we generally tend to ignore the education market and tend to not think about libraries, etc. But ebooks have had a tremendous uptake in higher ed and scholarly publishing as well.
Right. And finally, a theme, if I can try to put one down for the rest of the discussion, would be about this emerging screen culture that's out there, that perhaps what has gone away or is about to go away is the book as artifact, the book on the shelf, that there will be books on shelves, but there will also be books in this infamous cloud. There will be books on your various devices. Does that change reading at all, do you think?
I don't know. It absolutely changes something. I'll say this. I have a 10-year-old niece who got an iPad for her birthday in April. And she spent the weekend with me a couple of weeks ago. And I just was watching her with her iPad. And, you know, that thing is dead. It's going to break in about a week. I'd give it a week before it's completely broken. But then for most of the time she was playing on it, she was doing Club Penguin. She wasn't downloading books. She didn't really seem terribly interested in books, but she loves to read. The thing about the book that I think bodes well for its future is that the book is both the content and the device in one, and it's a pretty good device when you think about it.
Oh, it's great. It's got a search engine, right? The index in the back.
And it's a crude search engine, but yes.
That's right. And it doesn't need batteries or, you know, if you drop it, it doesn't break.
It, right?
Exactly. All those wonderful things. Well, Andrew Albanese.
Do you need a license agreement to keep it on your shelf?
Well, yeah, exactly. That's a good point. Andrew Albanese, features editor at Publishers Weekly. Thanks for setting the stage on that. And we'll be coming back to you in just a minute. I want to turn now to Rachel Cho. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to see you. She's Chief Marketing Officer for Open Road Integrated Media, which we should learn a little bit more about and have been hearing about just in the news yesterday. And in this role is bridging traditional world of book marketing with the world of digital media. And that's the emphasis for our discussion, I think, Rachel. But first, tell us about what Open Road is trying to do. And I think a good way to start is talking about the two principles involved.
The two principles, sure. Well, the two principals involved in the company are the infamous and famous Jane Friedman, who comes, as many of you know, from an incredible background. The past 11 years before forming Open Road as HarperCollins CEO global worldwide, and before that, roughly 30 years with Random House and Vintage and Knopf. Jane is really one of the incredible icons of publishing and is so well regarded in the field, and with that brings all of the contacts from the agents and authors and publishers, etc. And the other side is Jeffrey Sharp, who is an award-winning film producer who produced his first film, Boys Don't Cry, went all the way, as we know, to the Oscars, but also Revolutionary Road, proof he is one of the leading producers of book-to-film adaptations. And so the founding of the company, Jeff at the time had been working with HarperCollins. He had formed Sharp Independent at HarperCollins, and that was a film unit within HarperCollins working with Jane. And the two of them had always really wanted to form a company and be there so that from the moment of a contract, the moment of an idea, that an idea was formed in the author's head, that we could really be thinking about all screens in all formats. And so this company was really about doing that from the get-go, that every contract, every author we work with, we're looking at works and thinking about the audience, not only in the format of the physical book or the ebook, but what are we doing on the screen for the mobile unit? What are we doing on the large screen? What happens on the television screen? Seeing it as a 360 world.
There's a lot there to unpack because I think it really addresses some of the questions that this digital publishing revolution is facing. And you had an announcement yesterday that provides a good example, I think, of how you intend to approach all of this. And tell us about that. It's your first e-original title, and it's called Negotiating with Evil by Mitchell Reese. Tell us who he is and how this project is going to roll out in the next few months.
Sure. Our announcement yesterday about one division of our company, which is our e-originals. This is our born digital books, roughly 10 a year for our first year, going up to 20 after that. But these are books that In this case, an author came to us, or an agent comes to us, and they have not approached other publishers that there is a reason that they would like to go digital first. In this case, Mitchell came to us because he had an idea for a book and he wanted it out by the election. He didn't want to wait the 1 year to 1.5 years in order to go through the entire print process. He had something that he knew was valid to say now because the conversation is now. He was the undersecretary for Colin Powell. He's now the vice provost at William & Mary, about to become a president of another university. And he's one of the leading negotiators on terrorism. The book is called Negotiating with Evil, and it really is a case study of his work in dealing with negotiations from the IRA to Korea, you know, throughout the world, and the contacts that he's made, and the questions of why, when, and how we talk. And that's really what the book is about. Now, so he really saw, Open Road as a way to not only get the book out in time and to have this be of the moment, but one of the keys was that he came to us and asked us what we would do on the marketing side. And I think, to your point, Andrew, there are so many opportunities to get the work out and to self-publish. But as many of you know, finding good works and hearing about a work is like finding a needle in a haystack. And so our philosophy is that we're absolutely looking for the broadest audience and thinking about all screens. But we're also, from the time that the book is launched, meaning the release yesterday, the marketing and the publicity begins. And it's a very different cycle than that of a traditional publishing cycle, where you wait until that 4 weeks prior to on sale. The momentum builds, you have on sale, and then 2 weeks afterwards, that's the end. Our philosophy is that marketing is 365 days a year, and that we are constantly looking for new audiences, having the conversation to be ongoing. But also, it is a partnership with the author. And I don't think there's any way to get around that. It's either the author that's partnering with you. In the case, we launched the ebooks of William Styron last week. In that case, it's partnering with the family and with the archives of Duke University. But there has to be this kind of ongoing relationship to be authentic and part of the conversation and keep it going.
Right. So instead of, as you described, the traditional kind of launch and crash, there's right. This sustained glide. And I think that's important to the kind of tools you're going to be putting in place to have that happen. And that's where the marketing piece comes in, where Jeff's expertise on the film and video side comes in. Tell us about some things that are in the works for Mitchell's book, and then you've referenced the William Styron books. Tell us a bit more about your relationship with the Styron family there.
Sure. Well, for Mitchell's book, I'm actually not going to speak too much about it because we haven't rolled out all of the any of the plans yet. It's just launched yesterday. But it really is understanding his expertise and making sure that we're tapping into the communities that are already engaged in that discussion. And then we're obviously looking at the academics, and then we're finding also what we call our social champions. These are the people and the influencers, obviously, that are really have a gathering and are in this conversation, and then reaching out to them. And it's everything from understanding what information would be valuable to their readers, having Mitchell be able to create new information. And it really is that approach of kind of seeding the social media marketplace, but also just making sure that we're not forgetting about traditional and offline. So, yes, we will be doing appearances and talking to groups in Washington, et cetera. William Styron, for us, is a really fascinating look because here's an author that most of us, you may or may not remember the name, but he's the author of Sophie's Choice. He's the author of Darkness Visible, an incredible memoir about depression. But his book sales in print had completely dropped off. And so for us, it was about really, we're reintroducing him, but we're also bringing him to a brand new generation, as you talked about, and probably two generations of readers that have never read him. And that is a really exciting piece because we literally, we've been with his biographer down in Newport News, Virginia. We've gone and spent time at the archives. Rose Styron has been incredibly involved with us. We have a team at her house today. It is an incredibly immersive experience because I think in marketing right now, it is absolutely not about an author getting the green screen, being in front of a book, and doing a video that sits there for the 7 months that the book is in rotation. Consumers expect more. They expect to have some type of conversation or ongoing dialogue, whether that's through our videos, through photographs, through new archival material. And so the approach with Styron is not only to aggregate all of this content, but our approach is really looking at curating. Like, how do we put that information together? who's the right audience, what's the timing of the rollout for that. And that's a shift. You know, I think most people, when they get an amazing piece of photography or an archival letter that we have from Hunter S. Thompson, for example, you want to just immediately send it out. And we're doing a lot more of, you know, really planning and thinking about the timing and when and who is the right audience for it.
And you know, timing is always important, obviously. And one of the things that's happened since people started talking about e-publishing more than 10 years ago with various devices that are gone and forgotten, like the Rocket Reader and all the rest, is that we have in place now this social media sphere, world, really. And you at Open Road took advantage of that in a very, I thought, creative way just recently. Tell us about that.
You're talking about William Styron.
I'm talking about William Styron is now tweeting.
That was so interesting to see the response. And it was really divided between people that thought, well, what are they doing? Is that exploitation?
If I can say, Rachel, the headline in the Wall Street Journal was, you know, Styron returns from the grave or something
Exactly. and I thought we were quite clear in the bio that this was a chance for us to really make sure the voice of Styron in terms of quotes from his letters, the archival material, and the family, that we had a way to kind of broadcast that and make sure that people knew a place to go to get that information. And you know, it's picking up. We'll see. It's an experiment. I mean, the one thing that I love about what we're doing right now is that in product development, it's called an agile methodology. It is really looking at these 30-day cycles. It's experimentation. You have to be willing to try things. If it's not working, you stop, you regroup, and you try something else. That's very hard to do in a larger company. It's very hard to put a lot of resources in, then stop something and regroup and come back. And so our entire methodology is 30 and 60-day cycles. If you go to our website, in 30 to 60 days, it's probably going to look different. It really is about reaction and making sure that we're constantly experimenting and trying things. And in the digital space, you have to. Because as you can tell, the news, I mean, the next reader is out, the new using HTML5, so we're re-encoding our videos, and we can talk more about what that means aside from iPad. But you have to be on top of it, so you have to be nimble.
Right, and perhaps symbolic of that is your offices are in Soho. Mm-hmm. And I think that gives us an idea of the direction that publishing is probably moving toward. It's that startup culture, as you say, the kind of willingness to fail, openness to experiment that has to become critical, because the book business, the legacy book business, it needless to say, is a bit concerned about what that might mean if they did have to go down that road.
Right. I mean... It's interesting. I'm a big believer in that your space actually helps define you as a company and the day-to-day feeling. And so for us, it really was, we didn't want to be in Midtown. We wanted to be downtown in an open loft. I mean, Jane and Jeff and I are yelling across the floor to each other. Everybody is in an open space, and it really is that feeling of collaboration. I overhear something, and I jump into the conversation. We're doing a screening in the studio. Somebody else comes in, and it has to have that kind of that energy.
Interesting points there, I think, about energy and partnership with the author, Rachel Cho from Open Road Media. Thank you very much.
And you're welcome.
I want
thank
to turn
you.
Now to Kathleen Conkey. Kathleen, welcome. Kathleen is a New York City media and entertainment lawyer. She is editor and contributor to a new book called Counseling Content Providers in the Digital Age, which is just out from the New York State Bar Association. Prior to starting her own firm in 2007, she was vice president and senior counsel in the intellectual property department at MTV Networks. You've also worked for a whole cable guide of channels from MTV to VH1 to Spike, CMT, Comedy Central, and so forth and so on. You've been at CBS Broadcasting and were production counsel for Inside Edition and King World Productions. So I suppose the question is, what are you doing here if we're talking about books? And in fact, I think if we're talking about books, we're talking about so much more than books now. That's what does bring you here. But because you wrote the chapter in that new book, Counseling Content Providers in the Digital Age, on copyright, let me just say, so how does the day begin for somebody who's a content provider these days? What are they worried about?
What are content providers worried about?
Are they worried about getting sued?
Yes.
Why would that be?
At least from my perspective, I hope they're a little bit worried about getting sued, because every time you...
Well, lawyers are always worried about that.
Yeah, I'm listening to other panelists here, and I'm realizing that, you know, this brave new world we're in is one of full employment for attorneys, because... There is a constant flow every time we, you know, come out with these new technologies and new ways of repurposing old content and putting out new content. Then you have a whole world of new kinds of contracts that have to follow in the wake of that, new ways of looking at the old contracts. There's plenty of litigation to go around to reinterpret the contracts that publishers wrote, you know, 50 years ago, and try to figure out how they still work in this day and age. Because, as we all know, copyright at this point lasts the life of the author plus 70 years. So those contracts are going to go on for many, many years.
Well, how does that work in a publishing house? I mean, you know, we have to accept the fact that, yeah, a contract even written 20 years ago could hardly imagine what we are living in today. When someone thinks about how do I move a book, a print book that's gone, you know, on in a backlist and done very well for many years, how do I move that into the digital space? What are some of the concerns? How does the publishing house look at it, and how should the author or his or her representatives look at that?
Well, they unfortunately usually look at it diametrically opposed. It is an area already of litigation, and I think will continue to be, because there hasn't been the law is not settled right now as to the big thing you look at is who owns those rights. If you're coming out with a book in a completely different format, is it still a book? The kind of question that you're dealing with right now. And if it is still a book, then probably the publisher has the rights to publish that or to control it or to exploit it. If it's not still a book, then obviously those rights go back to the author or his or her representatives if he's passed on. And at that point, you know, do you go to a new kind of publisher like Open Road, or do you stick with your old publisher and, you know, license them to put out the new age book? There's all kinds of questions out there about that, and as I said, they're completely unsettled, because most of the old contracts just talk about publishing a book. And there's actually been litigation as to is an e-book still a book? And the authors want to say it's not, because that gives them the rights to resell it and you know, make money again off of it. And the publishers want to say it is, because they have the right to publish a book.
Right. And, you know, well, I think what's helpful about having you on the panel, Kathleen, is your experience in the media world apart from publishing, where I believe even MTV would have had book projects along the way.
Oh, yeah.
So you're familiar with this question of how do we manage an entire platform for a project, whether it's a series or whether it's a presenter or something like that. What are some lessons that your experience in that world might offer to the book publishing world?
Get all rights. The mantra at MTV was get all rights. And for years, and continuing now still, they are undergoing a major rights management program where they're looking back over their archives. And it's not just MTV, every single media organization, and not just television media either, print media, everybody, is looking back over their archives and saying, what do we have in here? What rights do we have to them? This is what I meant about the full employment for attorneys, because somebody's got to look at those old contracts and figure out what rights we still do, you know, the organization still has, and how do we exploit them in a different way now. Repurposing is, you know, the other mantra of every single media organization. We've got these stacks and stacks of old letters from a famous author, or you know, sports material in the CBS archives, or old television shows. How do we make that new again and resell it and market it in a different way? I think one of the interesting things that we're talking about when we talk about the enhanced book or the 360 book is that I think there's going to be a lot of interest in those kind of books for fans the people who are really diehard into a particular author or a particular kind of book. But I wonder how important it's going to be to the everyday reader, the people who just want a good read and, you know, move on to the next book. I'm thinking it may end up being a lot like the DVD extras. A lot of people get a DVD, watch the movie, and send it back to Netflix. That's how we do it now. Then there's other people who watch the DVD, watch the DVD with the director's commentary, watch every single one of the extras, and, you know, just really hang on every word. Those are the fans. I'm not sure, you know, how big the fan base is, whether it's going to be able to carry the amount of work and marketing that you have to put into this new medium.
It'll probably depend on the author or the platform, if you will, and maybe we could turn to our other panelists to get their thoughts on that in just a second. What I was going to ask about is whether you have some thoughts on the role that these various devices are playing and how that may make a difference in contract negotiations. Does it matter that a contract should be specific to a certain application, a certain device, and how do you manage that?
Yeah, the contracts that have been upheld litigation-wise in the courts as giving the most rights to the initial rights holder, the publisher, you know, in the case of books, are the ones that have actually been more vague, that have been broader in their reach by saying, and all media, now known or forever to come.
In this universe and any other.
And in the next universe and in Mars too, you know. Those contracts, the courts have been willing to interpret those to mean that whatever kinds of new technologies come along, we're still going to, you know, say that it's just a different platform for the same content or material. The contracts that have been more problematic are where, and I've seen these contracts, where you try to name every device that it might end up on, or you actually say, when you're talking about digital shorts or webisodes, you know, if you say, you know, iPhone or iTunes webisodes, you know, those are going to be very problematic later on, because who knows how long iTunes is really going to be here and when the next competitor is going to come along that just beats them to the ground.
Right.
So you want to just be broader on that. And lawyers started understanding this 20 or 30 years ago and started putting that kind of language in about all media now known or here to come, forever to come.
Right. Well, good points there for publishers and authors, I think, from attorney Kathleen Conkey. Thank you, Kathleen. And, you know, when I hear that phrase about in this universe and any other, I think to myself, if anyone's coming here from any other universe, they're not coming here for the book publishing industry, you know. They have other goals, I'm pretty sure. Well, let me, if I can, pick up on something Kathleen said, Rachel, and just ask you to follow up on. And that's that notion of the role of fans in all of this. I mean, you want people to become fans of these projects.
We do, but sorry. Wake up. We do want people to become fans of it, but related to your statement about fans and enhanced books, I have a couple things to say, if that's okay.
Please do. I've got a couple more questions, so don't worry.
Backing up for a second, the whole notion of enhanced right now, I just want to put it out there that every person you ask has a different definition of what enhanced means. And so for me, I actually completely agree with you that I call it enriched instead of enhanced. And for the moment, I completely agree, for the most part, about not interrupting the reading experience and about enriching that experience by surrounding the actual book with material that the DVD extra type of material. And in the Styron books, for example, We wrote these incredible biographies and did a visual timeline in the back through photography with the archives for the people that wanted to know more about his influence in his life, but it wasn't interrupting the experience of the reading. And I think the notion of enhanced absolutely is or something interactive, if you will, is out there. But again, it's a smaller subset of users that are asking for it. It's a smaller subset of material that actually it makes a difference in. Nonfiction comes to mind in many areas that it can give you a lot more. Yes, when it's a confusing recipe, to be able to immediately see what they're talking about, that's helpful. But in a novel and in some of the other nonfiction, you don't really want to stop that process. In terms of fans, I mean, we use the word fans, although now it's, I guess, with Facebook. But that's the kind of social champion piece that I think is really important. And to that end, I think it's important not only to have that conversation with fans, but for the Uber fans, it's also about giving them the materials so that they can make their own and create a viral effect. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we're going to be doing that, you know, a lot of publishers are not doing is creating what are called APIs, which are these protocols that this great marketing material, the photography and the interviews and the different things we're gathering will be available for people to be able to then create their own widgets and their own, you know, mashups, if you will, so that they can spread the word. And I think that's really, really what consumers are looking more for, is to be part of that conversation and part of the mix in creating that great material.
That's a great point. And Kathleen, you've got some experience in that that's really apropos. Tell us.
Yeah, the copyright issues for something like that are huge. When you turn that kind of material out to the world and say, you know, do with it what you like, obviously, if you're putting it out there like that, then there's permission involved. You know, I guess probably the experience you're talking about is when YouTube first started 5 years ago now. It seems like so much longer, but that's all it is. You know, the big thing that came along was what's called user-generated material, and it was mostly a lot of times fans, a lot of times artists, a lot of times just kids, and now everybody taking material that's out there that's already created, that somebody else owns, and mashing it up with other kinds of, you know, with their own songs or with someone else's songs, you know, sometimes taking two pieces of material and putting them together and then turning it out and saying, look at this, isn't it funny? That has caused a lot of copyright consternation by the owners of those original materials. You know, do I really want my stuff being used in this way? Do I want it being, you know, a lot of times it was making fun of it and, you know, there were parodies involved. And so a lot of times there's all kinds of issues as to whether the original copyright owners are putting it out there themselves and saying, do with it what you like, or they're actually trying to pull back on it and saying, I don't want you playing with my stuff. So the idea that there's publishers out there who are willing to, you know, get the rights and put it out there and allow people to play with it is really wonderful.
That's changing the game, I think.
Yeah.
And before we go to questions from the audience, I want to have Andrew just talk about that a bit in the context of the role of social media in the publishing industry, either for the publishers themselves or, as you observe it, changing reading behaviors and habits. So, you know, I think about reading as being the ultimate anti-social media in a way, because you sit there by yourself with your book in front of your face and nobody can get to you. But social media is changing at least the community of readers, I think. How is it changing publishers too?
Social media, hello again. I don't think you can underestimate the importance of social media. And I also don't think you can predict in what ways it's going to grow. But I can say so far with Shelfari and Goodreads and even Facebook and Twitter, the majority of the great things that I've learned about and read, I've gotten from a friend. So some of the traditional filters about how we find things, book reviews, you've seen book review pages shrink in daily newspapers. You've seen newspapers shrink, unfortunately. But social media has really been stepping up. Now, what I'm sort of amazed. Two things jump out at me about that. One is that I think publishers really need to grasp discoverability, visibility more. They need to find more ways to get their books in front of more people. There needs to be more surface area in the social media world, because let's face it, there's a lot of things that are more easy to access and play with: video games, movies, clips, YouTube, than a book. So if we want people to continue reading, I think we have to make sure we can get our books in front of people, at least on somewhat of an equal footing with other content. A lot of that content is free, by the way. And the other part of this is appending some sort of retail model to these social networks. I would really like to be able to, when somebody Twitters or Facebooks something, to be able to click on something and get access to that book, whether it's from a library, whether I buy it, whether I get a sample chapter. We haven't gone 1, 2, 3 yet. We haven't gone from Twitter to, you know, learning about something to actually having it downloaded to my phone or ordered to my house or something.
Right.
Well, Shelfari has started to, now that Amazon owns them. But
okay, well, I want to thank all the panelists for their thoughts, but now I want to try to ask you to contribute your questions. If you have a question... Sorry? Oh, we are in fact tweeting as we go along, and there is a hashtag. Hashtag BPP, and you, sorry.
Yes.
Right, hashtag BPP, and you can follow along at Copyright Clear. That's Craig in the corner there. So with that, if you have a question, I'd like you to think about who you want it directed to, okay, because we have one microphone for the three panelists. So if it's for Rachel or for Andrew, please just say who that is, and I think the first question here.
I'm directing this to Catherine. I'm Carol Harnoff, and actually I work for the Time Inc. magazine group, and copyrights and permissions in licensing is one of my areas. One of the big issues I have, and I don't think this is as big with books as it is with magazines, but still, I mean, there are so many bloggers and so many, whether it be a Twitter account, where our content, you know, our licensed content is appearing all over the place. And there's no way to really monitor this, even though, you know, people who are doing the permissions correctly, and we work with Copyright Clearance, actually, are paying for the repurposing. What, how do we address all these bloggers and everybody out there that's just using our content? I mean, can this be turned around as a positive, or what is your take on that?
Well, that's an area I'm very familiar with because I work a lot with newspapers and magazines, and it is a very different problem than what the book publishers face. It's the whole idea of news aggregation, and it's not just, well, it is bloggers, but it's big bloggers. It's the Huffington Post and you know, Media Bistro and all kinds of organizations that, instead of doing their own reporting, are just picking up, you know, the latest article from Time Inc. or Sports Illustrated, and sometimes maybe regurgitating it in slightly different words, and sometimes just taking the headline and the first paragraph and putting it up. And in fact, in the fast-paced world we're in right now, that's all that a lot of people read or want, is the headline in the first paragraph. So at that point, you've really taken the heart, as you would say in copyright law, of the piece. There are a lot of different ways that that publishers are trying to look at this and wrap their heads around it. One of the things that AP, the Associated Press, has done is to create a whole system where they are actively policing, they are watermarking all of their materials and actively policing where it shows up. And when it shows up on a blog's site without attribution and without licensing, if it's enough of it that it's not a fair use, it's, you know, actually a copyright infringement, they are going after those organizations and they are forcing them to license the material. And so they're putting out a lot of licensing contracts out there now.
Right. And what's interesting about that, I think, is that ownership matters, and it depends on the owner's desires what they're going to do with it. So in the case of Open Road, you're creating original material, but you're saying for some of it that you're going to put it out there because you want people to use it.
Well, just to be clear, I'm talking about the marketing materials.
Right, that's what we're talking about. Right, and that's original to you, so it's your stuff.
Right, exactly. Or it's in partnership with the author and in an agreement with the author that this can be used in X way.
Yeah. Right. We had another question? Yes.
Yes, this is a question for Rachel. I think it's one thing to mine already fully edited material like Styron, mm-hmm. or to be very nimble and agile and get Hunter S. Thompson letter out there. But you've got decades of J.D. Salinger waiting to be somebody's dissertation and somebody's editorial work, and it's going to be a long slog, of which manufacturing is trivial. The preparation and readiness for the market in whatever form is really the big thing. So it seems to me you still need an editor, and you still need folks to do a lot of the legwork to get it ready, and you'll never be ready for the election.
For Mitchell's book?
No.
Oh, just I think as a general question that Yeah. I mean, again, it depends on the author. If you're talking about J.D. Salinger, that's never going to be available.
Yeah, that's a whole other discussion.
Exactly.
Right.
But you were telling me before the program began that you were over at Duke University at the collection. So you really are immersed in that. It must be an exciting thing to be thinking about the contact with the author. It's a different kind of contact than you would have in a traditional publishing environment, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, it really was an incredible experience because us traveling down to Duke, we traveled with Susanna and Al Styron, the two daughters, and spent 2 days with 28 boxes. We'll be back again in 2 months. And the archivists there had already pulled out materials that they had gone through. We had looked at the indices. And, you know, it's really immersive. I mean, we were going into his father had these incredible scrapbooks dating back to his birth announcement. And putting on the hat, for me, I had only read two of his works. So I was putting on the hat of all of those other works that I had no idea about. And then we also had people with us that had never read Styron. So we were able to look at that collection and see what spoke to us. And then over time, what we're doing is, I mean, the archives have been incredible. We were able to digitize everything. We literally brought a scanner with us. And as we were talking, at every piece, we look to see who the copyright owner is. If it's the family, if it's a letter written by somebody else, then it's not our copyright. So we go into fair use and we look at the size of the letter. How much of it can we use and tweet out or put out there that leads back to the notion that, you know, that this exists, et cetera. But it's a really immersive experience. And many of the authors that we're about to announce have these archives and have these collections, and it really is a process, and it takes time, and it takes people. And it is that notion of curating. It is not just sending it all out into the wild.
Right. Hi, I'm Bill Rosenblatt. I'm president of Giant Steps Media Technology Strategies. We're a consultancy. Couple things. First of all, I wanted to respond to embellish the response to your question about monitoring uses of content. And what the AP does requires that you add stuff to the content before you put it out there, which she's called a watermark. They're really tags. And there are other tools available that don't require that, that just search the web for instances of published content and then let the publisher decide what they want to do. Do you want to send this guy a nastygram? Do you want to offer a license? Do you want to look at it and say, okay, this is fine. It's promotional. We'll let it go. So there are a lot of technical solutions that are appearing on the market, and some of them are free, as a matter of fact. The simpler ones are free. The ones that are simple and they don't work very well are free. The ones that work better and are more complex aren't free. The other thing I wanted, and we can talk offline if you want some more information about that, but I also wanted to address a question to Rachel and the gentleman from Publishers Weekly. You know, I hear all this business about how publishers and authors have to use social media. They have to get on Twitter. They have to have a Facebook page. They have to do this. They have to do that. They have to go out there and pound away at marketing their books. And then I hear about enhanced media or enriched media. And the one word that comes into my mind when I hear about all of this is cost. And in the good old days, you wrote a book, you gave it to a publisher, the publisher sold it, manufactured it, marketed it, and that was, you know, at a rough level, that was it. And now you're talking about both the publisher and the author having to just throw a lot of time, energy, and money into hopefully selling some of their product, which is the book. And so I'd like to get a sense from at least the two of you about where you feel that's going. Is the ROI being measured in any way? Is this going to end up being a bad deal for publishers and authors, or is there some light at the end of the tunnel?
And that's a discussion we started, I think, about the partnership piece. And I definitely want to hear from Andrew's perspective on that, because it addresses something you raised about advances in the changing world there. I mean, the relationship between publishers and authors is changing like everything else right now.
Amen. Amen, Bill. You're right about what's going. Anyone who's ever filled out an author questionnaire realizes how much the publisher depends on the author to sell their work. It's, you know, okay, we're going to sell your book now. Now tell me everybody you've ever met in your life and what they do and how I can send them a letter. That's always been the case. But with social media now, you see publishers asking authors to do videos and to spend time on Facebook and to Twitter and to do lots of things that haven't been shown to really sell a lot of books. And the big investment there is, of course, time. But a lot of authors I know have spent a lot of money on video production for lots of things that haven't really been shown to sell books yet. It's an incredible expansion of an author's responsibility into the marketing area. And the publishers have really shown limited ability to take this on themselves. I think we're entering an era where publishers want to give less advance money and put more into marketing, and it would be nice for an author to see straight out how much money their publisher is going to spend in social media and where they're going to put it in a contract. I wouldn't hold my breath waiting to see that happen anytime soon. So most of this will fall right to the publisher, right to the author. One place where it's been successful, I don't know if you've read Rebecca Skloot or seen Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. Rebecca's a remarkable author, and she's got tremendous energy, and she literally built her brand through social media. I don't think everybody can do what Rebecca did. She seems to be a dynamo. But it does show that, you know, it can work. She wrote a book, a science book, essentially, that, you know, debuted at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list, because for a year she used social media to get the word out about her book and create a community around it.
Well, NBC just announced there's going to be a show out this fall that a year ago was just a Twitter account, right? And then it became a book, and now it's a TV show, and we can't say the whole name of the TV show, but I think it's Bleep My Father Says, right? So there's an example of a success story, but probably for every one of those, there's a million wannabes in that. We have a question here.
Hi, I'm Ed Barinhouse. I'm a digital and broadcast media producer and consultant. And I think back to 1980 when MTV burst on the scene, and their editing style kind of changed the way television was put together. The fast-paced editing even became known as the MTV style of editing. And I think now to the digital paradigm shift that we're all experiencing, and 140 characters has become the new modem of communication, the Twitter account. Do you all see a trend in the way authors are writing for the online audiences in terms of constructing their books, in terms of the way they put sentences together? Is there any kind of a trend in your mind, or do you project something like that?
LOL.
Exactly. Andrew just said LOL. LOL. I have not, personally. It's more so of exactly that, about communication with the author and understanding of actually that has to be shorter and, you know, on the marketing side of things, getting to think in bite-sized nuggets and getting them to think about exactly what you were talking about, that generally people look at headlines. Then they only deep dive in, you know, maybe 1 out of 50 headlines. And so an author, ourselves, it's getting that kind of quick, fast-paced, you know, consistent voice out there. In terms of the writing of the actual book, I have not. I mean, I don't know if you have more to add.
I haven't really seen it in the writing of actual books, though I have seen Twitter feeds now being turned into TV shows and books. But I can relate one experience where we had a search engine optimization specialist come in and talk to us at PW about how to get our articles viewed more. And to boil it down, it was he brought up a headline, Dog Drinks Beer. And how that kind of thing gets a lot of hits because people see dog drinks beer. Well, I got to see this. And the idea of boiling down a serious topic or an article to dog drinks beer horrifies me.
Well, you know, what's interesting, and Rachel's been talking about looking into archives. There was an announcement about a month ago, I believe, that all the Twitter accounts in all the world, which just seems crazy to me, are now going to be archived at the Library of Congress. So maybe your daughter or your granddaughter will be doing a project with a book, and it won't be going to the Duke University Library and looking at all these old paper letters. They'll be reading the tweets of an author today, which is quite a thought, I think. Do we have some other questions here? Yes.
So we talked a lot about books as being kind of a way to generate revenue for authors. Is there something that's maybe not as large as a book, so selling chapters or selling case studies or selling other pieces, that are there some examples that are out there where people have been successful in doing that, and could that be kind of a next stage in terms of being able to pull out some revenue from the internet and for authors?
A good question. I mean, Andrew, mini books, or Rachel? I mean, are there mini books, or Kathleen?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think is something to think about is that Things that started as short promotional pieces years ago have now become monetized. So if you think about it, going back to MTV, music videos were originally produced as promotional pieces. They were given away free by the labels to anybody who would take them. Please put this on the air, because it was a way to advertise their bands and to get you know, money into people buying the records. And the same thing happened with webisodes. There would be little short pieces about a particular television show that you would stick up on the web, and people would come to see it and get interested in seeing the television show and get driven back to the TV and hopefully push the ratings up. All of that stuff now has become monetized, and you can actually sell it. So everything that we think about, you know, I'm wondering if we're going to start selling our tweets soon. everything that everybody's trying to monetize this stuff in some way or another. I did read somewhere recently about selling books a chapter at a time. Goes back to the way books were, originally written. Dickens wrote his books, for little articles in the newspapers.
In the newspapers, yeah. Right, right.
I can't answer to the success side of it, but there are definitely a lot of examples out there with people doing a chapter at a time. And it's interesting that you talked about the difference for the writing and whether or not tweeting and short messaging has affected writing. I can tell you that it's all affected the way that I think of a new product, a new book coming in, and whether or not we serialize, whether or not we think about chunking it. You know, every project that comes in deserves that publishing look to think about the right way to deliver it. It's not necessarily, here is the book, and the book then becomes the full book over here. I think every project that comes through our door, there is a conversation about what the format is, what the other screens are. All of that is part of it.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, we have another question, please.
Yes, my name is James Fay with Level 85. I'm very interested, Rachel, to hear about how a book is prepared for multiple platforms. Publishing for the iPhone is very different from publishing for the iPad, which is different again for publishing for other ways of distributing new books. Is that a collaborative effort with the author? How much is done after the fact? What's the difference across the various platforms?
Well, generally speaking, in terms of digitization, there's digitization and distribution. And in digitization, there's generally third parties that have come into the picture. They're huge. And you send them your files, and then they do all the formatting into the different, formats. EPUB is supposed to be the industry standard, but then there are flavors of EPUB. So you have your EPUB that goes out to the Apple Store, your EPUB that goes out to Sony, etc. But there are companies that do that for you. And then you get the files back and you do what's called QA or quality assurance, and you test them on the different devices yourselves. They test them and then you take a look at it. And it's the same that goes for entering, video or photos or anything else. I mean, obviously not every device takes it, but you do the formatting via these third parties, and then you get the files back and take a look. Is that what you're talking about? Or
That does answer the technical side of the question, but I think there are creative opportunities. I mean, very different if you're going to take advantage of publishing for the iPad or publishing for other distribution
That's back to the enhanced question. And if we're truly talking enhanced, we're not talking about a lot of us are seeing with, a video here or a link out here. If we're really talking about an immersive experience, which is generally right now, I don't know how many of you have downloaded. If you have an iPad and you haven't downloaded the Elements, you should download it. It takes you back a little bit to the CD-ROM days because it's all the kind of bells and whistles, but it's an interactive look at chemistry, basically, at all of the elements. And you can wear 3D goggles and look at and turn them all, and it's all through an app. That is the Uber enhanced to me, and that makes total sense for a lot of the visual dictionaries and things that we're talking about. But to your point, if and when we end up doing that type of experience, it is absolutely a back and forth with the author and thinking about the story direction. At what point do you want to have somebody be able to stop? It's really about the editor, as I think you were saying. The editor plays a crucial role in understanding that, as well as your interactive and digital side, because you have to really look at the flow, if you will, of the information. So it's a collaborative process.
Okay, yeah. We have time, I think, for one or two more questions. From somebody new before we come to you, I want to be sure I get to everybody here. Okay, sure.
I'll introduce myself. I'm Bob Whitten with Arrowton Group. I had a conversation last week with an author for Harlequin, and she was talking about how authors are smitten with the notion of self-publishing because the economics appear to be right. But the first statistic we heard today was about the 750,000 ISBNs taken out last year. It seems to me this is a little bit like a high school point guard likelihood of starting in the NBA. And so you still need, to Rachel, a wonderful marketer to bring this thing to market. No amount of low barrier to entry tweeting is going to get everybody on the bestseller list.
You know, and Andrew, I think maybe we can have you take that one. But it seems to me, and there's a book I want to recommend, which I've been recommending for years. It's called So Many Books, and it's published by Paul Dry Books out of Philadelphia. A translation from Spanish, actually, a Mexican journalist. Series of essays looking at readership and writing in the age of abundance, and addresses some of the points I think you're getting at. And what the author points to is that not every book needs to be a bestseller. If there's a book that has 500 readers that are right for it, that's right. If it's 5 million, that's also right. But there is no right or wrong answer in it. At the same time, I think what you're kind of getting at is, can you make money selling 500 books? And that is an important question. But Andrew, from PW's perspective, since that explosion is happening, since it's so much easier to become a publisher, do you make distinctions between houses, you know, between the independent house with the onesie-twosies or the big five, big six?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't work on the book review, but I can tell you that we don't really have a mechanism set up to review self-authored, self-published books. So that's a strike against them, that right there. I'm smitten with self-publishing. I think there's a danger of getting back into the old vanity publishing, the V word there, and there are a lot of companies out there that are ready and willing to take advantage of authors who have not been able to crack the traditional system. But my hope and what I've really enjoyed watching at Publishers Weekly is the explosion of small presses, really, really small presses. The kids that are coming out of MFA programs and realizing that they're never going to get a shot to get off the slush pile at a major house. And starting communities, most of these communities are web-based, but they end up starting small presses that want to produce books. They do short-run titles, 500. They publish their friends. They publish the books on their communities. There's imprints like Publishing Genius. And in New York, we have a great book called New York Tyrant, or a great imprint called New York Tyrant, that has a great book from Eugene Martin called Firework that's coming out in July. It's a masterful work. It's twisted, but it's masterful, and I'm not sure that it could have worked at a major house.
Well, I think any book that has twisted but masterful
people just send
on the ad, somebody will want to read that. Yes, well, we had this man first, and we're almost running out of time.
Hello there, I'm Jerry Ashton. I'm one of those authors to be. And I'm investigating the different publishing routes, and it's almost like coming to a table loaded with opportunities, whether it be self-publishing, small houses, whatever it is I might do on my own. But I'm creating a book online, which is actually being crowdsourced. The name of the book and the website is writtenoffamerica.com. And it's all about the financial meltdown looked at from the viewpoint of someone who's a credit inflection specialist. So I want to thank the panel for making my search for the best route so much easier. And thank you, Bill, for making this possible.
My name is Eleanor Haas, the Calyx Group. We've been working the last few years with a major global publisher of professional textbooks. I'm hearing the whole publishing model of this company has to change radically in terms of product development. They have amazing editors. I've met many of them. How do these traditional editors learn the new ways?
I guess you start at the beginning and move from there. I don't know. Andrew, do you attend some, I'm sure, conferences and programs where you meet with editors from these various kinds of houses. Do they express agitation or excitement? How would you gauge the mood in the publishing community?
I'd say probably both in equal measure, but overwhelmingly excitement. How do they look? You're talking about editors at traditional publishers?
Or at a textbook publisher.
A major professional textbook. Well, it's an extremely different world. Well, I think for scholars, the ability to do a textbook now is easier than it's ever been. The ability to market is easier than it's ever been. And the market itself, I have to say, with textbooks and technology, with things like the iPad, etc., the licensing market for textbooks is going to be enormous. Where I'm concerned, really, where the editorial filter comes in, is what's going on in Texas right now, where a school board has decided that, you know, the truth isn't conservative enough for them, and they're going to tailor the curriculum, and suddenly we're going to see one textbook used in California and one textbook used in Texas that all have different spins on history. If there's an agitation among editors right now, I think that's going to be it, is you know, sort of creating this reality for different parts of the world.
Can I bring Kathleen into that? Because your book talks about, you know, counseling content providers in the digital age. Do you get into that at all? I know most of it's legal. It's about copyright and all of that. But are you able to offer any suggestions about how to get someone who's coming from, you will, the legacy publishing to embrace this new world?
Yeah, it's not anything that we deal with in the book. But one thing that does occur to me that ties in with the book is that everything happens so fast now, and everybody has to work at such a fast pace that you don't have the same kind of time between writing and publishing for a lawyer to step in and help avoid the legal problems that can happen once publishing happens. So that's something that I think the digital age is, the time crunch is causing a real problem with. There's going to be more libel suits, privacy suits. People who don't have time to discuss with a lawyer or don't even understand that there might be legal problems with what they're writing are immediately going, you know, sans editor, sans publisher, online and publishing, and they end up with a lawsuit in their hands. But no, I think we're all in a very difficult job market right now. We're in unfortunately interesting times as far as figuring out how to turn our old skills into what's needed now.
That's the ancient curse, right? To live in interesting times. Well, it's been more than an interesting discussion. I want to thank our panelists, Andrew Albanese from Publishers Weekly, Rachel Cho from Open Road Integrated Media, and attorney Kathleen Conkey for joining us today. My name's Chris Keneally from Copyright Clearance Center. Thank you all for being here, and we'll turn it to Bill.
First of all, let's give Chris a big hand.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.